This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You hear about a crashing ecosystem, from climate disruption to disappearing species and landscapes. What to do? There are two options. Try to organize social change or attempt to escape to a safer place. In this show, you will hear a bit of both. From 3CR Radio in Australia, Vivian Langford explores personal carbon rations with Tina Fawcett. She's the author of the book Suicidal Planet. Then California permaculture podcaster Diego talks with Canada's permi guru Rob Avis, how to find an anti-fragile place to live. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where the search goes on.
Radio EcoShock.
Vivian Langford produces and hosts the Beyond Zero Emissions radio program on 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. 3CR broadcasts Radio EcoShock every week as well. I'm going to play you the first half of a program as Vivian talks with Tina Fawcett. Here is Vivian on 3CR.
And everything can change.
Tonight's show is about carbon rations and sort of big picture thinking. I've got really powerful thinkers from England. Tina Fawcett's in Oxford, and she was part of a British government inquiry into carbon rations. The British government thought, we'll look into the feasibility of it. You know, they'd rationed petrol, for example, in the Second World War, and it's a big thing to roll it out, but it is a way of making sure everyone gets enough of a commodity and that you don't overdose on things, you don't do it excessively. Right. And it's like a Mikey card that tells you how much you've got left each month of your carbon allowance. But then the British government said, well, this is an idea before its time, you know, we're not going to do it just yet. But I think we should still have this. It's a concept of, she calls it carbon allowances rather than carbon rations. And we still need to get the carbon down, especially Australians with a much bigger carbon footprint, say, than Europeans.
Dr. Tina Fawcett has pursued the topic of personal carbon allowances in many articles and in the book The Suicidal Planet. The UK government committee which looked into it found that carbon rationing could become essential, but the government said it was an idea before its time. But how would it work? Would it be forever? And would it hurt? We have to think about the reasons that we have to do this, and we've got someone from Oxford University here. So Dr. Fawcett is here by Skype, and I'd like to welcome you to the Beyond Zero Emissions show, Tina.
Thank you.
I would like more people to become carbon literate, you know, to share the burden of climate change that a lot of people do feel, but not everyone. And I think that it would spark innovation, and people would demand rapid decarbonisation from each other as well as from our leaders. So tell us, why do you like the idea of carbon rations and allowances?
I think there's two main reasons, really. One is it focuses us very much on what our global carbon budget is, and it sets a cap, and it says that's got to reduce year on year, I mean, as international negotiations are doing. But this is a mechanism that brings it right down to the personal level. And so it sort of connects us with this global issue in a very tangible way. The second thing I really like about it is that it's equitable. I mean, you can argue about different interpretations of equity, but what it says is everybody's got an equal right to emit carbon emissions within this budget. And so it's not saying if you're rich, you necessarily can, you know, as of right, can emit a lot more. If you're poor, you just have to emit a lot less. It's starting off by saying everybody's got the same rights to this sort of scarce resource of the amount of carbon we can still emit and live within a safe planet. So those are the two key things, really, the effectiveness of the decreasing cap, making it personal, and, well, I suppose that's three things, and making it equitable.
Yeah, tell us how it works.
Okay, so how it would work is it wouldn't cover all the carbon in the economy for people, or the simplest version is it would cover your personal travel, so possibly not by public transport, but certainly by car. It would cover your home energy use, and it would cover flying. So you would have an annual amount of carbon credits or whatever they get called in your account. And when you paid for your petrol or diesel at the petrol station or when you paid your electricity bill, you'd have to have carbon credits deducted from your account as well as the money. If you didn't have any carbon credits left, if you'd already, you know, bought a lot of energy that year or had a sort of overseas flight or two, you would be able to buy additional carbon credits on the market from people who sold them who didn't need all of them. It's not really a parallel currency, but it's a little bit like that in that you have to think about both the money and whether you've got any carbon allowances left to spend that year, and if not, are you prepared to pay the price to get more?
Well, at the moment, I think it's not very easy to find out what the carbon content of an activity is. For example, just recently I took a ferry from the Australian mainland to Tasmania, and not even the captain could tell me what the carbon footprint of that ticket was. And I wonder, do you think we need to start with that information on every ticket and on every petrol bowser?
Yes, I think that's a very good idea. People often talk about how if you were going to bring this idea in, first people have to understand what the impacts of their choices are, where carbon, the sort of big carbon emissions from their everyday choices are coming. So certainly having carbon on, yeah, that's right, at petrol stations, at filling stations, having carbon on your energy bill when you get your energy bill at home, having carbon on your airline ticket. And some of those things happen now. So quite a lot of airlines will sell you a carbon offset, which is kind of a different story, I guess. But there are some forms of energy are quite easy to translate into carbon. But I think you're right, particularly ferries, it's very difficult actually to work out the carbon impact is.
Well, I'm going to follow that story with that captain because, you know, he said he would talk to me about it. But I just think that we must be able to get on top of that sort of calculation. It's not rocket science, surely. Look, about carbon allowances, do you envisage like a trial period when people would get a free carbon allowance or an app on their phone and their house and travel carbon would be clearly displayed, and then after that year they would not be able to buy more than the average amount unless they paid more, and then it would ratchet down the next year and ratchet down so that eventually you'd be having a very small carbon allowance? Is that how...
Yes, I mean, I think you've described it extremely well. That's the sort of thing we would imagine, that there would be to be a learning period with no penalties for everybody, when everybody can get the hang of what is this new system, what does it mean to me, what choices am I going to make? And then you would gradually bring in, you know, keep moving the budget down year on year, because after all, that's the point of the scheme, is to reduce our carbon emissions as a society. Mm. And we know we need to do that by some mechanism, and this is one way to do it. It's not the only way, but I think it's quite an important idea to discuss.
It is an important idea to discuss, but I can't get anyone to discuss it because I think they think that pandemonium would break out if they couldn't do the things that they now are very accustomed to doing. Even though they say they care about climate change, they really don't want to forswear anything.
No, I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? But not we all, but if you look at public opinion surveys, most people are in favour of doing something about climate change. It doesn't mean they're in favour of not, you know, making that rather nice overseas trip that they wanted to make. And it's a challenge to all of us to sort of have to reconcile our ideas and our hopes for the future with our current behaviour. On the other hand, I mean, some things you can change really easily and reduce your carbon emissions, particularly on the home energy side. There's lots of technologies, there's lots of changes in decisions about what temperature you set your air conditioning or your heating at that can actually make quite a big difference with a very small impact on your lifestyle. If anything, your lifestyle is going to be better in a more efficient home because it's going to be warmer, less damp, you know, just a more pleasant place to live. So there are some win-wins out there, as well as the more tricky ones where actually you will have to lose something if you're living a lower carbon lifestyle.
That's good. But what about, there's a problem of equity here, of course. How would you smooth out this system for people who are renting or cannot afford to insulate their home, or people who need to drive a lot for their work or for their other responsibilities, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is challenging. And there's some researchers in the UK, the Centre for Sustainable Energy, did quite an extensive modelling exercise looking at people's carbon emissions across transport and housing by income group and by location, and looked at how many, what they called was sort of low income losers, there would be under a system of equal allowances. And what you find is most low income people do better because their emissions are lower. It's the higher income people tend to have higher emissions on average. But of course, not everybody is average. And they found about 20% of the lowest, the people with the 30% of lowest incomes in the UK would actually lose out under this system. In other words, their carbon emissions are currently higher than what their allowance would be. And that's usually because they're living, as you said, rurally. They've got to travel further. There aren't public transport options for them. Or they're living in uninsulated homes that are hard to heat. And so naturally they have a higher carbon footprint, even if they're not very warm, because all their heat is going out of the walls and the roof. There isn't a simple answer to that. I think that the real answer is the sort of infrastructure that the government provides and society provides, enabling people to make lower carbon choices. And that's easiest in housing, and it's more difficult in transport, I think.
Right. Well, is it true that the British government committee who looked into the carbon allowance scheme decided that it was an idea before its time? And I'd like to know, what were their main objections?
Yes, that's right. It got quite a lot of political attention very early in its life as an idea, when there was really very little research base. So they commissioned some research from various people, and that's right. Although they found a lot good to say about the idea, their two main objections they had was, one, they said it wouldn't be public acceptability they were concerned about, and the second one was what it would cost. Now, to speak about public acceptability, there's been quite a lot of studies, most of them quite small, on what people think of this as an idea. And it depends what you compare it with, really. If you compare it with doing nothing, people would rather do nothing. If you compare it with something like a carbon tax, generally people would prefer a personal carbon allowance. So it's all about how you frame the questions, really. It's not to say there would be no objections. Of course there would, but it's what you compare it with, what are your other choices. On cost, yeah, I mean, the government came up with a figure. Some other researchers came up with a figure that was half of that. As we know, I mean, those were 10 years ago. We've all got a lot more used to sort of all sorts of mobile apps, mobile banking, all sorts of sort of information exchange systems. And really, under personal carbon trading, you're exchanging very small amounts of information. It's only carbon when you pay bills or buy air travel or buy petrol or diesel. So I don't think the costs are a main issue. I think it's probably the politics, the public acceptability, and what people think about equity that are the main issues.
This is Radio EcoShock with our guest host Vivian Langford on 3CR Community Radio in Australia. And later, we'll be talking about permaculture.
Well, I think one of the elements in the politics, at least in Australia, where our government's constantly getting into power every time, praying for jobs and growth, more jobs, everything has to be consumed. You know, we are praised for being consumers. And I think there's a belief that if you suppress demand in the economy on anything, transport or overseas flights, tourism or, you know, even heating and cooling the house, that the economy will stagnate or collapse, and people feel that they're actually doing a good thing by flying away on a holiday because they're boosting local economies. And there's this moral sort of feeling that you have to keep pumping it out for the whole economy to support us. And I wonder if we fear economic collapse more than irreversible climate change, or is there another way to look at it?
Well, I mean, I mean, I think certainly a lot of my research is just on the sort of nuts and bolts of energy efficiency. And in that, there have been quite a lot of research trying to look at, so if you had a massive investment program to make housing, our housing in the UK is very inefficient, to make housing really efficient, what would that do to jobs and growth? And what the studies normally show is actually, if you sort of transferred capital into making houses a lot more energy efficient, you would actually drive low carbon jobs. You create more jobs than you would destroy by spending the money on that rather than on something else. So to some extent, there's that argument that if you're moving to a low carbon economy, yes, okay, some jobs will go, but new jobs will be created. And, you know, there's a balance there. And certainly some research says that's quite positive and it can be quite good local, highly skilled jobs that are sort of meaningful work for people. So there's definitely some positives there. And I think, you know, the wider question about what does a low carbon economy look like? I mean, obviously, personal carbon trading or allowances is only a small part of that. And there are quite a lot of, you know, people doing serious work looking at this. There's in the UK, there's a guy called Tim Jackson who's just written the second version of his book called Prosperity Without Growth. Yeah. And there's another woman called Kate Raworth written something about donor economics, which is about sort of a just society living within climate, you know, global environmental limits. So sort of economists are trying to look at how do we restructure societies. I'm hopeful they'll come up with some clever answers.
Yes, me too. Well, I think the language we use is important, and I noticed in your articles you played around with that, that rations have connotations of austerity and even wartime, and allowances sound fairer and make you think of people pulling together, but personal carbon trading makes people think of rich people buying up poor people's allowances so they can go on with a climate-damaging lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, the language is really quite interesting. And to be honest, we haven't done proper focus groups on it. What we've had is quite a lot of feedback from people. So the main work the first work I did on this was with a man called Meyer Hillman. And Meyer's in his 80s now and actually lived through the Second World War. And so for him, when he started developing these ideas, he was using the language of rationing as something very positive, something that enabled everybody to get fed in the UK. It's based around food rationing, because the government decided if it didn't ration food, the unequal access meant, you know, some people would be starving. And so in his view, rationing was a very positive, socially just sort of word. Whereas other people, audiences, when we talked about our work, people were going, oh, you can't call it rationing. And to them, rationing was all about austerity. It was about doing without. And so it's a word that has different meanings for different people. So we decided to switch to allowances because we thought that sounded a bit more neutral. And then the language of trading came around because trading is part of it, because of the starting point, because people have, in the same sort of income groups, have very, very different carbon allowances. We needed to introduce trading, and that became an umbrella term. And I'm personally a little bit uncomfortable with it in some respects, because as you say, it directs attention onto the trading aspect, whereas I think the important bit is the allowance aspect. It's that this is your share aspect that I feel is more resonant than the, oh, and by the way, if you need a bit more or you don't need all of it, you can buy and sell.
I think we've got to start thinking about this, and that's why I think the personal carbon would get everybody thinking. You know, there's nothing like necessity being the mother of invention, and I really like the idea of a lot of people putting their thinking caps on about it as their daily aggravation about having just this allowance to work with would spur innovation or creativity, and I wondered if you've got some examples where it has.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think we're all aware at the moment there's quite a lot of technological innovation around, particularly on renewable electricity, so solar PV. I know that's quite big in Australia, believe it or not, it's actually quite big in the UK as well. Well, we're very much upping our amount of electricity we get from wind power. So certainly on the supply side, there are sort of hopeful things happening. We'd also be thinking about things like social innovation. So, for example, bike share schemes and city bike schemes in Britain and, well, across Europe, those are, you know, really taking off, and giving people active modes of transport is, you know, is clearly good for people's health. It's good for all sorts of reasons, and it's also low carbon. I think, you know, as you said, if people were all operating within a budget, or they were trying to stay within their budget because they didn't want to face excess costs, and it became the social norm of, you know, you take pride in living within your budget, then you would be looking at, say, different forms of holiday. So maybe holidays nearer to home that were nevertheless exciting and interesting for people, and you'd expect providers to come up with those. You might expect more sort of car sharing type schemes. You might expect public transport to be a bit more attractive to people, and more investment to go into that because people would be looking for alternatives. And all sorts of, I don't know, perhaps new services. You've got some sort of carbon doctor that comes into your home and helps you sort of spot the obvious things where, without investing very much, you can improve, you know, you can reduce your carbon emissions. Like you said, I would expect, I mean, I'm an academic, I'm not an entrepreneur, but you'd expect all sorts of people, if there's a new opportunity opening up, all sorts of people would come in and help us live within our carbon budget.
As an academic, I imagine you have plenty of people to talk to along the same lines, or like-minded people, but do you find in your life, just in your general life, that it's a rather lonely thing to be worried about climate change?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? Because I sit in a bit of a bubble. So I work somewhere called the Environmental Change Institute. So, of course, it's one of the biggest environmental changes that everybody's interested in. And just locally, our politics are fairly green in Oxford. So probably meet less sort of climate scepticism or less resistance than you would in other sort of local areas. That's just, you know, makes it probably too comfortable a place to work. So quite privileged from that point of view. But nevertheless, it doesn't mean we're all doing the things that we really ought to do. And it doesn't mean we're taking the more radical steps that we ought to take. Because, you know, as we all know, nothing's happening, happening fast enough, and we probably still haven't really grasped what it is we need to do and how fast we need to do it.
That's right. And the focus for climate activists in Australia is all on the big things, you know, phasing out coal-fired power stations, stopping new coal. We've got a big one here at the Galilee Basin with Adani. Stop Adani is a huge, you know, taking a huge amount of activism to stop that. And gas exports, we're meant to be the Saudi Arabia of gas in Australia. And we're trying to phase in wind and solar energy, but it's still only 17% of our total energy mix at the moment. And is coming out of many examples of that have been coming out of community initiatives. So there's a big appetite to do something, I think, at a personal level, because people are exasperated by government. They trusted in government. They didn't have much experience before, and they thought government would take care of this big new problem. But in fact, governments, it's just toxic for them. It's just political suicide to take on any big climate action. At least here it is. And so we have all these little things like bike paths and solar-powered roofs, but I think we need everyone to be thinking about it, be thinking about decarbonisation and what it involves. And the scale of the transition to clean energy is staggering. So I'd like to know, just to finish from you, how easy would it be to administer carbon restrictions? I know there was quite a big bureaucracy in the wartime to do the other sort of rationing, petrol and food rationing. It was quite a big bureaucracy to make sure it happened and make sure it was fair. But do you think it would be a big deal to implement this?
No, I think the actual implementation shouldn't be too difficult. I mean, the cost is one way of understanding what a big deal it is. And I think even the government's estimates, which people thought were a bit high, was the cost per year of running the system would be something like £30, which is €35. I don't know what that is in dollars, but I mean it's not much. Basically, it's not, you know, I mean, yes, it's a sum of money, but it's not a huge sum of money, and the setup costs would be similar. So, and, you know, and other people have said actually it could be half that cost. So I think that shows it's not necessarily a huge big deal, because it's really quite a simple thing, particularly for the direct uses of energy where we know what the carbon impact is. It's a very simple thing. That cost shouldn't be too much. And how you would sort of manage it would basically be through the big energy supply companies. You know, they would have to make sure the numbers added up, the people who are selling us the energy, and the airlines, and maybe the ferry companies when we know what they're up to. They're the ones who'd have to sort of prove to government that they hadn't sold more than the set of allowances that they'd got in from people. So, you know, there's some cost to them. And of course, we'd expect to see, as you mentioned earlier, sort of more information. So information on energy bills, information at petrol stations, information from airlines. But a lot of that's already happening. And certainly in the UK and across Europe, with smart meters coming in, there's a lot more sort of feedback and information is coming to customers about their home energy use and, in fact, business energy use as well. So there's all these opportunities for communicating with people that are already there that aren't a new cost. And the actual mechanics of managing the system, you know, compared with other things we do in society, are quite small. So I don't see that as the problem. I think, as you know, as we talked about earlier, it's just, you know, having the social agreement that this is a really important priority, and therefore we're going to put up with this minor inconvenience of having to pay in carbon, and we're going to have to put up with the learning to understand what it means to live within a carbon budget and how to manage that. Because if we don't, the consequences for us are so much worse than putting up with that. And it's persuading people that it's a price worth paying. We have got to do something. This is a way of doing it fairly, transparently, and in a way that sort of engages everybody.
And I said at the beginning, would this go on forever? Because it seems to me it would only need to go on until we have decarbonised. Or is that naive?
No, well, I mean, that's what you'd hope, wouldn't it? That in, I mean, who knows, 30 years' time, we're kind of a largely zero carbon energy system, and therefore that's not necessary to have that sort of thing happening anymore.
Yes.
So, yes, you're right. If it's successful, it should fade out, because we've fixed the supply side as well as the demand side, and we don't need to do that anymore. Yeah.
And then hopefully that consciousness would attack the things where there's embodied carbon, like meat. And
that's right, with the idea being, because something's happening on the other side of the economy as well, that sort of relative prices or in some way will be changing, and so the sort of low carbon foods and goods and services should be seen cheaper to consumers. And you know, if we're living in a society where we've recognised that carbon's a major constraint and we've all got to deal with it, it's not only about the prices, is it? It's also going to be about, you know, social norms. It's going to be about individual morals and ethical responsibility. all driving people to lower carbon choices and driving suppliers to come up with a lot more lower carbon choices.
Thank you very much, Tina. I think listeners will have lots of questions about that, and maybe, I hope, does get some impetus, more some more stimulus. You said at the moment there's not a lot of oomph going into it at the moment, but I hope in the future it does come back on the table as a good plan to refine, and that the idea will take spark somewhere. Okay, so that was Dr. Tina Fawcett. She's the Acting Deputy Leader of the ECI Energy Program at Oxford University, which, as she said, is a bubble, but it sounds like a very pleasant bubble. And thank you for talking to us, Tina.
In this last show of the season, you just heard a sample from Vivian Langford from the Beyond Zero Emissions Show on 3CR Radio Australia. Vivian follows up with an interview with famous British author and journalist George Monbiot. Find a link to get the whole show at bze.org and in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. As many of you know, a few years ago I left Vancouver, Canada to find a more sustainable home and a healthy place to grow more of our own food. Many people have that dream. But what should we look for and what should we watch out for? From California, Diego Footer has a great podcast series called Permaculture Voices. I tuned in to episode number 226, titled Tips and Thoughts for Buying an Anti-Fragile Property, with Rob Avis, Part 2. Here is Diego with Rob Avis, co-founder of Verge Permaculture in Canada.
Welcome to Creative Destruction and the Voices of Change. I'm your host, Diego, D-I-E-G-O. We've all heard that phrase, be the change you want to see in the world. Today's episode is part 2 of the Anti-Fragile Property series with Rob Avis of Adaptive Habitat. If you missed part 1, go back and check that one out. That was episode 222. You don't necessarily need to hear that one first, but it might put today's episode in a better context. Because in that episode, episode 222, we looked at the idea of owning land as insurance. And today we're going to take that discussion of finding an anti-fragile property a step further and take a look at how you should approach purchasing a property if you're worried about things like climate change, the financial system crashing, debt, terrorism, disease, water insecurity, or a fragile food system, or all of them. Any, all, or none of those issues could hit you in a significant way during your lifetime. They might not, and they might. So if you're worried about them, how do you protect against them? One way is through property, specifically an anti-fragile property. What's anti-fragile? As Nassim Taleb defines it, it's simply something that gains from disorder. If we have a broken food system, your food forest becomes more valuable. If we have an energy crisis, an off-grid homestead, and a timber stand, keep your devices running. But that food forest, the technology, and the timber stand are all things that sit on the land. Today, we'll look at how to pick the right piece of land to make what you put on it more meaningful, or simply not even needed at all. Here it is, the Anti-Fragile Property Series with Rob Avis of Adaptive Habitat, Part 2. So I'm back with Rob Avis, and last time on the episode, we talked about land as insurance. And I want to hit on some of the points that we touched on in last episode before we start to move on in this episode to how you can actually look for a property and what Rob thinks you should focus on when looking for a property. To start with here, I want to start talking about the idea of the anti-fragile property, you know, creating the ultimate enduring asset. When you think about the anti-fragile property in terms of like people who might be listening to this show, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I think the best way to start talking about this is to first just refresh people's mind about what anti-fragile actually is. And so if we think about fragility in three states, the word fragile, most people can wrap their head around what that means. The thing that comes to mind usually for most people is thinking about a package that you're shipping to a friend that might have wine glasses in it, and the glasses are probably going to break. So fragile things break when you create volatility or disruption within the system. And so knowing that, the middle state, which is resilience, and a lot of people think of the word resilience in the ecological field, resilience actually means anti-fragile. But in this state, we're going to actually provide a little more granularity in these definitions. Resilient things resist breakage. So they are resilient against volatility or disruption. So concrete is a great example of that. You can hit it with a hammer. If you hit it enough times, the concrete will chip, but it's not going to break. And this is why we built buildings out of concrete. Anti-fragile things are things that actually improve with volatility. And the easiest way to think of this is your body. And so if you lift weight and you create little micro rips in your muscles, those little micro rips will heal back stronger than before you were lifting weight. And in fact, anti-fragile things have another characteristic, and you can think about it in the reverse, in that when you remove volatility from an anti-fragile element, it actually atrophies. And so our bodies, again, are a great example of this, in that if you stop working out, if you just sit on the couch for the rest of your life, your body's actually going to atrophy. So creating a metaphor over to the property side of things, properties that are anti-fragile, and I guess it depends on what it is that you're insuring against, because this concept of anti-fragility and property can kind of be looked at as a form of insurance as well. But let's say that we're concerned, like a lot of the clients that come to us are concerned about the future, and they are typically concerned about energy disruption or food disruption or water disruption. So the first thing you have to ask yourself is, what is it that you're trying to protect against? What kind of volatility are you trying to work against? And so if it's food, well, then you're looking for properties that can produce tons and tons of food. And so in a normal circumstance, when everything's fine around us globally, this property is going to continue to produce food. Where it benefits from volatility is that the food value coming off of that property in a volatile food situation, let's say the food system struggles or has some sort of a disruption, the food coming off of there will be worth far more. The property value will increase. We could look at that through water. We could look at that through the finance lens as well. Properties that insure against water disruption, energy disruption, food disruption, they're going to have considerably more value if any of those systems are disrupted through any number of, you know, events, essentially. So they're essentially properties that benefit from a certain dose-dependent amount of volatility, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm following you there. And I think that's what a lot of people are looking for. They want to prevent that shock in the system coming back to bite them. Water security, food security, I mean, they're becoming bigger things just with the drought I've seen here in California. You're starting to see even more, I'll call it average people, start to pay attention to water issues. So when you think about these types of properties themselves, what type of things do you think they need to have on them to create this anti-fragility in the property when it comes to a human-based system where humans are interacting and managing the property?
Really, it comes down to the fundamentals. And those fundamentals are, because we live on a planet that is predominantly or is operated through biological systems, we can go right down to the fundamentals of biology and what those needs are. Because realistically, I mean, we've all come to rely on electronics and all of the technology that runs on electricity, essentially, and some of them run on fossil fuels. And actually, a lot of our electricity comes from fossil fuels. But as we know, that we're in a very rapid transition from fossil fuels to renewables right now. But fundamentally, like if a severe disruption occurred in any number of those areas that we discussed, I would much rather be saddled with a really biodiverse, healthy, thriving ecosystem, fundamentally operating on biology as an insurance package, than be relying on a whole bunch of technology. Now, I'm not saying these properties shouldn't have technology like solar panels and batteries and all the other stuff that that we're embracing right now. But when it comes down to what a property should have, I think one of the most valuable things that a property can have, and one of the things that I look through, the lens that I look through most often, is water. We can do a lot to enhance water cycles. We can capture what's coming onto the property. We have a really neat opportunity up here in the northern hemisphere where we get snow. I mean, you think about this. When I see a snowstorm outside, a lot of people just look at that as snowflakes falling from the ground. But there's actually millions of gallons of water falling from the sky. And if you look at a property through its interaction with wind, snow, rain, wherever you live, if you live in a place where you get snow seasonally, we can look at the property through that lens of how can we capture more snow on the property. We can literally create water harvesting elements in these northern climes just by putting up snow fences and completely shift the whole water dynamic of a property. But if you buy a property without water, it creates all sorts of interesting constraints that are really tough to come back from. Solar access is another one. A lot of people that come out of these ecological design courses, permaculture design courses, all talk about, especially in my climate, getting south-facing slopes because they've got this really great hot microclimate. And I'm not dogmatic about the microclimate that you end up with. It's all about, you know, working with it, essentially. And in my climate, we're pretty dry up here. Maybe not quite as dry as California, but, you know, we get anywhere from 10 to 15 inches of rain in metric. That's, 300 to 330 millimeters of water, which isn't a lot. And so I actually really like the northern aspects for microclimate as well, because those are generally are a lot more moist. And so we can do all sorts of interesting things that we can't do on a southern aspect. So I like to get a variation of microclimates on a property as well. That's going to give us a lot of opportunity. I like to know what kind of nutrient, like all biology needs nutrient. And so it's good to know kind of where the soils are at, both microbially and from a nutrient perspective. And then it's good to have a good sense of the proximity to markets as well. I mean, not everybody wants to start a business on these properties, but I like to look at the kind of regulatory and market opportunities that exist around these properties, because it creates optionality, essentially.
But one thing you stressed last episode, and you've talked about before, is people tend to buy the wrong piece of land driven by sentiment. So they might know that they want these characteristics, but is it their vision of how these characteristics are starting on the landscape or how they implement these characteristics on the landscape that sometimes lead them down the wrong paths? Meaning, I think in one of the examples you had, this might have been in a blog post, somebody had a lot of water and they wanted to drain the water to create a farm where it was like preserve the wetland and just create a food system within the wetland itself.
Totally. I see more properties purchased that are incorrect than anything else. And I think it really comes down to a couple of things. Number one, we're really good at going to the grocery store and buying $5, $10, $100 things. Like, we do that on a semi-regular basis, and we're good at doing comparative shopping, looking at the benefits, looking at the reviews, trying to understand the pros and cons of buying one thing or another. And if we get it wrong, it's not the end of the world. We can buy the one that we thought we didn't want that actually was better than the one that we ended up buying. And it's not really going to cost us a lot. But when it comes to buying houses, most, or even properties for that matter, most of us might buy one, two, three, maybe if you're really wealthy, five or six in your lifetime. And so we don't have the same amount of repetition, basically, when it comes to buying property. And so we tend to look at the lipstick. And by lipstick, I mean things like view, how nice the kitchen is inside, you know, does it have a clawfoot bathtub? All these types of things seem to take precedent. And what's interesting is that the humans adapt really quickly. And so that view that you thought you wanted, you probably won't notice it after 2 or 3 years. And maybe you will. Some people do. That kitchen's going to wear down over time. These things that you think are important aren't really important. So I would say sentiment is one of our biggest limitations to culture, or cultural sentiment is one of our biggest limitations to yield. Yield being kind of propelling us towards our goals, essentially. It's kind of funny because sometimes I actually think I'm more of a marriage counselor than I am a land consultant, because inevitably one part of the couple wants one thing, one part wants the other. And so they end up kind of arguing about what's important and what's not important. I actually wrote a blog once, I think it was a couple of years ago, and it was something like avoiding the tears and buying the right piece of property. Because I kept getting so many couples that I don't go into these things trying to make people cry, but inevitably they end up crying, because when you're dealing with $500,000 or $1 million and you realize that you've got the wrong property and it doesn't propel you towards that vision or that place that you want to be in, it's a really expensive mistake.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We're listening in to a discussion with permaculture podcaster Diego and his guest, Rob Avis, co-founder of The Verge Permaculture in Canada.
You're right. I mean, those are essentially features. You know, in marketing, there's that saying, features tell, benefits sell. And a lot of times features are what people go after when they buy things. Like this 5-acre property near me came up from sale. And now hearing you think about this or talk about this, I'm trying to like step back and say, okay, don't just be attracted to the number, the size of the property. There's obviously a lot of other things that come into that. But I fully get literally right now how easy it can be to see something and then start progressing the dream, you know, right now in your head of what it could be, what you might want it to be. And that doesn't always align up with various things, your holistic context, what the land can actually give you, what's best for the land, where do you want to go, you know, if this is business related. So there's a lot of factors here. And I fully get like this problem of sentiment. And I think this is a problem you see people make on even small purchases up to land itself.
It's really important for people to think about what a high-level goal is. It's not granite countertops and, you know, a view of the ocean sort of thing. Those are not high-level goals. Those examples would be detailed goals, so things that you can see when you're really close to it. High-level goals are kind of goals that you'd see at 30,000 feet. They're visions. They're characteristics that can be achieved in many different ways. So what's really great about spending time setting goals on the front end is that we can test different opportunities against those vision statements using the framework, using the holistic context framework to understand whether or not it actually provides the largest thrust towards those visions. What it is that we do is we take those goal statements and we translate it into qualifiable and quantifiable metrics that our clients can use to go and test various options against. And that's the piece that, like, when somebody hires a real estate agent to look at land, there's a couple of things going on there. There's a huge conflict of interest, first of all. The real estate agent is supposed to be there representing, you know, your behalf. And some of them do this for sure. They're not all, I mean, the system's set up with an inherent conflict of interest, but there are some really good real estate agents out there. But ultimately, they're being driven by the commission at the back end. When you can get somebody involved that actually will start right from those high level goal statements that can represent you, and that they've already been paid to render a service, it doesn't really matter to that person which one you end up getting. The thing that matters to that person is making sure that his customer is happy on the back end for the service that they've been hired for. And just to hit on the context a little bit more, I think that the other thing that's really important, after you have those goal statements, I think the other thing to really think about, the question that always, I use this in my business, I use this with my clients, I use it in all aspects of my life, is what's the weakest link? What is the thing that you're trying to achieve by, in this case, buying a piece of property? And is that property, that 5-acre property that you're looking at, is that going to address your weakest link? Or is there another way that you can deploy the capital or the time or any of the resources that you're looking to deploy to give you a greater thrust towards that end vision? And so that would be one of the first questions that I would ask after I had sat down and created these high-level goals with people, is what's going to give you the greatest thrust? And is this going to actually address the weakest link?
I think many times the bite of our mind is much greater than the ability of our body to physically act out on some of this land. So many of us have these grand land aspirations, but I don't think everyone has the time to do everything that they'd ever want to do on that land in a way that matches the quality that they have in their mind's eye, or they don't have the capital or the amount of labor to actually get these visions into reality. So I think, going back to the sentiment, I think people fall in love with these ideas without checking it back against the reality of, can I realistically ever make this idea happen in the real world, given all the other things happening in my life, job, kids, whatever. And I think that's where I think a lot of people get hung up, even me now thinking like this 5-acre thing. I mean, that's always my check, is like, I'm having trouble maybe managing less than an acre. You know, if I go 5 acres, I won't be able to maximize that nearly as much as I am now. And then that means I'm totally changing around the management system I have on the property. And then that goes back into context of like, does this more spread out, wide scale management style across more acreage, is that really what I want to do? And does that line up with where we want to go?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a little of the episode that we did on raising kids. And one of the listeners wrote back and said, oh, I'm working so hard to, you know, to build out this farm for my kids, and yet I'm not spending any time with my kids. And so for you and me, our context is very family-centric, and that represents a really big part of our high-level vision, is having that freedom of time and space to be with our kids. You know, for other people, that those high-level visions are going to be different. You know, Newton said it best, whenever you, every action has an equal and opposite reaction, and trying to understand how these decisions are going to interplay into that reality, basically, and which, by making this action, what other moving parts in the system are going to get affected, and trying to be a little bit more conscientious about that is really what all of this stuff comes down to. And so that's the goal side of things. Once you've kind of figured out what those goals are, then we can start to get into some of the mechanics of and like translating some of these high-level goals into reality.
What do you think about this? You know, a lot of people come into this space and they want to find a property to then live out this vision on. They might want to make the anti-fragility on the property. And to do that, they're essentially going to permaculture the shit out of the property. They want to follow in the footsteps of what you do, what Ben Falk does, Sepp Holzer, Darren Doherty, Jeff Lawton, etc. And there's a way you could design anti-fragility into these properties anywhere in the world. But for somebody who is business-centric, family-centric, and they're looking for this anti-fragility, do you think you can buy a property that has natural conditions of anti-fragility in it that you as a human can exploit? Meaning, if you select the right property, you don't really do anything to it. There's not any management. There's not any hardcore earth scarring coming in, because the systems are in place, be that water systems or a forest system. And by you just purchasing the property smartly, you've built your fragility, anti-fragility in that way. And then you don't have to take time away from the other things in life you may want to or may have to care about. Because I see that's one route. The other route is you buy a property and you essentially, you work with nature or whatever, but you kind of beat it into submission.
No, totally, man. I mean, we've looked at properties. There's this incredible, this romantic idea of raising livestock. A lot of us have it. A lot of us want to control livestock or manage or work with them. But I've often said, like, why not hunt? There's actually a diminishing number of hunters in North America right now. Hunting is a really crucial part of ecosystem management. And in a week of time in the fall, like, I can go out and harvest enough meat for the entire winter. Maybe I find a local pig farmer and I buy some of his lard or a little bit of pork here or there. But, you know, just siting your house or finding the right piece of property that has access to wild productivity, and then training yourself in some skills that I get this all the time. People will buy these properties in forests and they'll be like, oh, we got to cut the forest down so that we can grow pigs and chickens and cows. And like, why? You've got deer, moose, and elk right outside your door. Get a gun and learn how to hunt. Buying a property that has water rights. I think water is going to be the master resource in the future. And having a piece of paper that says that you've got rights to water coming off of a glacier is an incredible asset. Number one, you'll be able to drink, which is really important. But, you know, down the road, there might be other opportunities that water provides that you can't anticipate right now. We can't do anything without water on this planet. Having access to timber and biomass, like living near or inside of a forest, as long as you've taken into account any of the risk factors that may be associated with living in that forest. You know, one of the things that concerns me all the time up here, being a mechanical engineer, is the fact that it gets down to minus 30 degrees Celsius, which is pretty close to minus 30 Fahrenheit. And, you know, in the prairies, we live largely without trees. And so, and our houses are built in a similar fashion to the way they'd be built in California. So a minus 30 situation in the middle of winter with a failure in the electricity and or the gas grid means no heat. And most of these houses aren't built with wood stoves. And even if they are built with wood stoves, there's no wood to burn because we live on the prairie. And so for every ecosystem, there's a way to build. There's resources that you can acquire or that you can manage that don't require you to have to pummel the ecosystem into submission just so that you can meet your specific romantic goal of raising livestock or growing avocados or whatever your vision is. There's lots of different ways of meeting those goals. And it really comes right back down to the goals. Like, what is it that you're trying to create insurance around? Because that's really what we're talking about here, is just finding alternative strategies to ensure risks that you're concerned about or that you've identified as being things that are fragilizing you.
Yeah, it's got me thinking of something you mentioned in a previous podcast of where you now disclose to clients, like, my recommendation may be to do nothing. And in a lot of cases, I feel like there's so many ideas, and I'm guilty of propagating a lot of these ideas out there in this space. A lot of that sounds interesting. A lot of that sounds fun to do. It's unique. It's fun to dream about. But in many cases, hearing you talk, it's like the best option may be to just do nothing, to buy the system that is already running itself, that you don't have to do anything in except come in, you know, establish a house, get your basic systems up, and then just manage as you need to based upon your needs. It's a very high level, almost like Zen level of thinking in this space, because it kind of renders a lot of the techniques that we've learned. There's a bit of saying, well, I'm never going to need that, or I'm not going to have to use that. You know, nature's done this for me. So maybe you can observe maybe use all the stuff you've learned to observe these features in nature to come upon the place, but not having to do them, I think, is wise. And it also takes a massive amount of restraint, because I think the natural instinct is to come in to a system that might solve all your needs in and of itself by itself, and then come in and start doing stuff just to do it.
One of the things that any individual can do, whether they have money or not, and they'll end up benefiting themselves in so many other ways, you know, without even owning land, is just teach yourself how to fast. You know, that's a perfect example of right now I eat about a meal a day is what I'm averaging. Sometimes I eat more than that. I'm not wasting away. In fact, I'm getting stronger. My body is actually getting stronger by limiting the caloric intake. I've solved a couple of medical issues. So at the lowest level of value, my health's improved. I'm actually spending less money on food than I was. I feel better. I have more energy. My brain works better. And on the highest level of value, you know, if a food disruption ever did happen, I've actually started to train my body and my brain to fundamentally function on fewer calories daily. And so how can you buttress your life with things? By having the right piece of property, buying it in the right piece of land, investing in the right infrastructure, making sure the right characteristics are there. There's all sorts of mental things that you can do to harden yourself. I mean, we as North Americans live in climate-controlled conditions, 21 degrees Celsius all the time, summer or winter. You know, we expect 3 meals a day. You know, we have all these things. And a lot of times what's really interesting when you go down this path of trying to create resilience for people is that trying to replace a North American lifestyle, so the 30 kilowatt hours of power that we consume a day, the 375 gallons, sorry, I should use it in talk in Imperial as well, 75 to 100 gallons of water, or 300 to 400 liters of water a day, you know, flush toilets, lights whenever we want them, trying to replace that level of supply, I guess, is super expensive. And so you inevitably, the resilient or the insurance policy on the back end inevitably has to be much smaller, which if people are thinking ahead, they should be kind of coming to the conclusion that they should be teaching themselves to live with less right now. It goes right back into what the Romans were talking about in their concept of stoicism.
So thinking about this, before we jump into the idea of what to look for in terms of buying land, you know, a checklist, if you will, do you think the approach is to first say, how do we buy the right piece of land for the North American that wants plug-in technology, 21 degrees C temperatures all the time, showers that just turn on? Or do you think that the approach to buying land starts with you restricting things in your life or paring back what your expectations are to start? I see those as two separate approaches that might not lead you to the same property.
Yeah, they're totally different. It's really going to come down to dollars and cents at the end of the day. I mean, we've definitely worked with clients that don't have a budget. And so their systems can be set up in a way that there'll be a seamless, most likely a seamless transition from the system that we have right now to, you know, whatever system may happen in the future if a disruption would occur. And then there's clients that do have budgets. You know, those systems look a lot different. Those properties may look different as well. Sometimes the property can be the same. Sometimes people will have goals of living within a certain bioregion. And so you kind of have to work within that bioregion. Because there's so many variables, there's really an unlimited number of possibilities on the back end, which is why I think people struggle so much to buy the right piece of land. And so the good news is that because there's so many ways to iterate, you know, you can usually work through a situation. The thing that we're trying to do more than buying the right piece of land, because there's so many ways to do that, is to make sure that we don't buy land with type one errors, like things that you can never come back from. That's the most important thing. So instead of trying to solve the affirmative, we make sure that we avoid the negative, if that makes sense.
It does. And just for people listening, can you elaborate on what type one errors might be?
Yeah. I mean, buying a house in a floodplain, that's one that I see so often. And this comes back down to black swans and statistics. People will say, well, you know, this hasn't flooded for 500 years, or I'm on a 1 in 500 year floodplain. A lot of people that don't understand stats might think, well, that means that I'm only going to live for another 60 years, and therefore a 1 in 500 year flood is never going to happen. That's not how statistics works. We could have a 1 in 500 year flood 5 years in a row, and it could still be a 1 in 500 year flood. So understanding kind of the watershed and where your infrastructure lies within that watershed, that'd be a type 1 error. Buying a house in a forest where all the trees around you require, or the tree seeds, I should say, require fire to germinate those seeds. So you're in a fire ecology, and then not having the ability to protect your infrastructure because you don't have enough water resources. Buying a house that has a sump pump that runs every 5 minutes. I mean, making a house like that have the ability to be off grid is almost impossible, because all your money, you're going to basically spend $5,000 to $10,000 on a solar system just to run a sump pump. And so, like, I can go through like item after item after item. There's lots of things that, like, people set up properties incorrectly, or they place elements in the wrong place, or you know, I had a client in Ontario talk to me about a property that has a really steep road, and I was like, and she said every year this thing washes out. Well, if society just continues to go on as it will, which I think it will, you know, I'm not a doomsday or anything like that. I just think about things through that lens of insurance. But at the very like lowest level of situational occurrences, that driveway is going to have to be repaired every year, and it's like $1,500 minimum. Not to mention you have to have special tires to get up it. You've got like all these other things that go along with having a road that needs lots of maintenance. And then in the event that there is a disruption, how are you going to get up that road? There's like little booby traps everywhere you go on properties. And, you know, your house inspector will look for a certain number of them. But there's all sorts of other things that they will never look at because they're not coming at it from that insurance or anti-fragile perspective.
We're running out of time here on Radio EcoShock for this hour. Let's let Diego wrap up his show, and then I'll pass on how to hear the rest of this interesting discussion on finding the right place to ride it out.
To read some of Rob's writings, visit vergepermaculture.ca. And finally, if you're overwhelmed by all of this and you don't know where to start and maybe thinking, I just want Rob to do that, he can. To learn more about Rob's design work and his design firm and some of the services they offer, visit adaptivehabitat.ca. To download some of the highlights from this episode, visit permaculturevoices.com/podcast and click on episode number 226. So get to work, find something that you love and fulfills you, and go for it. The journey will be hard, you'll want to quit, it'll take everything out of you, and odds are that you'll fail. I hope that you do it anyway.
That was Diego, host of the Permaculture Voices podcast. I highly recommend it. Tune in at permaculturevoices.com. Of course, I'll put loads of links in my own show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. In September, I'll be back with another year of all new Radio EcoShock shows. Starting next week, I'll be pulling some of the really big interviews from past Radio EcoShock programs going back as much as 12 years as our summer programming begins. These scientists, authors, and activists stand the test of time, and they are worth your time, so please keep tuning in. As always, thank you for listening and caring about our world.